Welcome to the Red, White, and Rude, episode 45. I am your host, William Del Pilar, where we're serving truth with a side of snark. Tonight, we kick off with Bill Maher crashing Trump's dinner party. Spoiler alert, it's less cage match, more romance. Then we're diving into the spooky, the cinematic, the streamed, and the pixelated. Think UFOs popping out of the ocean like cosmic corks. Minecraft outgrossing Hollywood's ego. Gina Carano giving Disney a legal wedgie. And Ubisoft stock tanking faster than a noob in a boss fight. And you know what, people? We've all been there. So grab your popcorn. This hour's ruder than a MAGA hat at a pride parade. Before we get going, my friends, and welcome back, do not forget to bookmark grumblingsmedia.com. Grumblingsmedia.com, where you will find this podcast, my other podcasts, as well as our sports and political podcasts as well. And I'm sure you're probably watching us either through YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, or Pandora under the handle Grumblings Media for those who aren't aware. So let's get right down to it. Bill Maher stuns Democrats with Trump dinner revelations. So in a surprising turn of events, comedian, I guess you could call him a comedian, more outspoken liberal, Bill Maher attended a private dinner with President Donald Trump. And it was, yes, it was at the White House on March 31st. And this was facilitated by Kid Rock, a staunch conservative, though we did catch him drinking Bud Light once. So obviously this encounter has already been detailed through multiple sources, but it did reveal a civil and unexpectedly engaging side of Trump, per Maher, and it challenged Maher's long-held criticisms, and it did spark widespread debate, not really amongst conservatives, but amongst his own people, leftists. And Bill Maher is not libertarian, as some want you to believe, and he's not a middle-of-the-road liberal. He says middle-of-the-road things, but he's a hardcore leftist. Why his hate of Trump? So I don't think overall this dinner changed anything in how Bill Maher's going to treat Donald Trump, but he was cordial, he was polite, and I think he was just impressed at the fact he got invited to the White House, and it happened, and the president was extremely cordial and very polite to him. So he's obviously, by what I've just said, and for most of you who know, Bill Maher's a longtime outspoken leftist Democrat. This was a private dinner. It was at Kid Rock who did help set it up. And Dana White was also in attendance. Barr said the evening was civil, surprisingly pleasant, and it was a stark contrast in terms of the usual critical stance Trump has towards him and vice versa. Obviously, as you can tell, that was a small gathering, very intimate. So they got to talk a lot of back and forth, I would imagine. For those of you not aware, Bill Maher's already 69. I got to admit, the man looks pretty good to be 69. He's a host of HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, which is a late-night talk show format that blends comedy, interviews, and political commentary. It's pretty much known for its political commentary now. So he has a built-in reputation as a liberal voice. He started out more libertarian for some people, then he just went full-blown leftist. I don't know why. So he mocks Republicans, especially Trump. He'll chastise Democrats, but he never mocks them, you know. So his feud with Trump does span years. Maher's called him, or names like a narcissist, authoritarian. Trump's retaliated with a sleazebag, low-life dummy. At the end of the day, what you have is Bill Maher, a pure-play leftist who feels leftism has gone too far, though I'm sure he probably did vote for Kamala Harris if he hasn't already said it, which means it's not far enough for him not to vote for her. So these people like Maher, they may say one thing, but when it comes to that polling day or voting day, cha-ching, Democrat. So I always take everything he says with a grain of salt because they tend to lie a lot, and he does, in terms of his middle-of-the-road statements versus how he votes. You know, and I bring that up because he's been on the crap crusade against Democrats. He wants them to shift further to the center. Maybe that is who Bill Maher is. But he's still voting hardcore leftist because he won't vote Republican. You know, so he has claimed to be someone who dislikes both political extremes. And I get it. But again, when it comes to voting, he still votes Democrat. So the dinner, getting back to the dinner, it was initiated by Kid Rock, who is obviously a big Trump supporter. He appeared on Maher's podcast, Club Random, and he proposed to have, hey, let's have dinner with Trump. And Kid Rock said himself that, hey, man, I took a bit of risk here. And what he wanted to do was to show that Trump could be civil to Maher, and he wanted to see if they could bridge some divides. And face-to-face interactions always reduce hostility. So that is true. Let me tell you something, people here. All the stuff we say online, we never say to one another's face, myself included. I, in my defense, and I always say this because it's the truth, I never attack anybody. I react to them. And, well, you're attacking them. No, I'm reacting to them being bleep holes, to them attacking somebody else, to them saying something that's a lie. So, yeah, I will respond, but I won't go out and attack somebody openly just to attack them for clicks. Now, Trump, he didn't really care for this meeting. He's got better things to do. It's true. Bill Maher's not a leader of a nation. He's not somebody of importance that's going to sway policy or anything like that. He's just a talking head. So he said, okay, let's do the dinner as a favor to Kid Rock. He stated it might be fun or might not. So obviously, Kid Rock was pivotal in all this, and he was at the dinner. Now, this past week, this past Friday, he talked about this. Not Kid Rock, but Bill Maher. He did a 14-minute monologue to what he called his book report on the White House visit. And as I said, this wasn't a meeting of anybody. It wasn't a big summit meeting. I think Bill Maher himself played it up to be a big-time summit meeting, then downplayed it, giving his book report. But he was pumping this up because it was a big moment for him in his life. He'd never been to the White House, never been invited, despite being a big-time Democrat donor and a Democrat voice. So he did not go MAGA. Yeah. And he faced no pressure to do so. He said Trump was gracious, said Trump was measured. He found his demeanor surprising compared to the public persona. We don't. We have come to learn from many individuals over and over and over that is who Trump is in person. He's a real person, a real guy. That drives all the TDSers, the Democrats, progressive, and mainstream media, because Trump is likable. So Maher was saying that Trump, quote, a different guy one-on-one, unquote. So I think the big question here is, how is Bill Maher going to treat him moving forward? You know, Maher noted that Trump laughed, including at himself, was not fake. He says he knows what fake is. I guess the big thing is Maher had his staff have a list of insults Trump has done about Bill Maher, and there are about 60 of them. Put them all on a sheet of paper and asked Trump to sign it. And Trump did. Though they did cover serious topics. The Gaza conflict. Trump's proposed third term. And there were obviously lighter moments and jokes. So it was probably a real in-depth conversation. You know, and Trump, true to his nature, will discuss anything. Why do I say true to his nature? People, when has Trump not taken a question from the mainstream media? Trump is the media every day. And the media is always knocking him. Yet he's front and center answering their questions. You know, I wish Maher would have talked about that, but he didn't. He did say that Trump was willing to discuss anything. Quote, he's willing to talk about stuff, and that's better than giving 2.5-hour speeches into the wind. And that's Obama, Biden, 2.5-second. Joe Biden ice cream. Oh, Joe Biden will go down in history as one of the worst politicians in American history. So, Bill Maher did get out of this. Trump's open to dialogue. He says he did challenge Trump on issues such as praising Obama's Iran nuclear deal. See, the problem with Bill Maher praising Obama's nuclear Iran deal is we don't know. They didn't let inspectors in. So, he can sit there and say anything about the reducing their uranium allotment, etc., etc. And that's what I would immediately push back with. Where's the proof? There is no proof. In fact, they wouldn't let our invest nuclear inspectors in. And in fact, when they did, it was obviously with so much notice they cleaned up their mess and hid it. He did sit there and say that Trump was open to criticism, stating, quote, I criticized him to his face and he was fine with it. And he says that surprised him. I just think Trump is above all that. He's like, yeah, it's a little guy here. I'm dealing with world leaders now, this or that. So he loves the battle. He loves jabbing back and forth. But when push comes to shove, he's like, yeah, come on in. Because he was in Trump's domain. Now, I say Josh Rogan or something like that on the show that same night was saying, well, Trump was using it as optics, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if that was the case, Marr's not stupid. He would have gone. Marr bit back at him. This guy, Rogan, you know, Trump could walk on water, and this guy, Josh Rogan, whatever his name was on the show this past Friday night, would sit there and say, well, Trump's racist towards water. I mean, come on. You know, so Marr did contrast Trump's engagement with other prominent figures he's met. He said Trump was more attentive, meaning Trump was into the conversation. See, what you get with President Trump is what you see on camera from the sense of the type of person he is. He'll take any question, he'll talk any issue, and that's what he did with Marr. He just did it in a polite, civil manner because they were right in each other's face, and there's a human decorum. And social media kind of destroys that. It has destroyed our thought process in what we believe in terms of what or how we view one another. It's different in terms of what we believe when we're behind a computer versus what we believe when we're in front of somebody. We don't believe anything. And we look at our own jaded responses. But when we're in front of them, we tend to believe, okay, we can talk. We can have dialogue. I remember I was talking to the San Diego County Democrat chair. Oh, we're not that far apart. This, that, super polite. She was at an event, a debate I was putting on. Then a week later, she calls us all Hitlers. I'm like, yo soy Latino, idiota puta, ¿verdad, carajo? You know, that really irked me. But it shows who and what Democrats were and are. So Marr noted conversational style, including no BS. It was very direct. Now, he calls Trump a liar. Trump's a storyteller. Marr's a liar. I've caught Marr in so many lies he stated on that show, and he pushes the lie. And when I say Trump's a storyteller, God, what comes out of his mouth is like a showman. That's what Trump is. When I want to hear Trump's policy, I'll go to Scott Bessent, you know, Marco Rubio. You know, I'll go to people in the cabinet who can voice the policy much better than Trump. But Trump is calling the shots. He said that he did receive hats from Trump, but appreciated that Trump did not ask him the pose in one. So what were Marr's takeaways, his reflections, his takeaways? He said he felt more comfortable talking with Trump than he would have with Obama or Clinton, despite voting for both of them. I wouldn't feel as comfortable talking to Obama or Clinton as I did with this guy. Think about that. Speaks volumes in the type of person Trump is. And Trump is much more self-aware than he lets on in public. Like I said, I know too many idiots who believe they're smarter than Trump. They truly do. In their hearts, they believe. I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. I see how you're living your life. I see the decisions you made in your life. I see the business acumen you have. I see all of this, and you're none of that. This guy's brutally successful. Took X amount of dollars to turn it into $5 billion. Now, granted, you got to be ruthless, have a bit of sociopath at that level. That's not Trump. That's across the board. So Marr says he still has concerns about Trump's administration. This was a positive step. Now, he's getting pushback from his own people. And let's be honest. That's expected. They want hate, hate, hate. Jimmy Fallon showed he had no cojones when they pushed back when he had Trump on. And he was saying the same thing that Marr was. And what happened? They ate Jimmy Fallon alive. He had no balls, no cojones. He's not really a man. He's not what you call a man, Jimmy Fallon is. Because anybody who buckles bends the knee to morons, you're not viewed highly in anybody's book. We know how he makes love to his wife. It's called the Amazon position. So Marr did enjoy the evening. And he's not endorsing him. But maybe this will change how Trump is seen, you know, from him when he talks about him. Now, Kid Rock, who facilitated all this, he was on Fox and Friends, and he went on other outlets as well. He said the dinner was, quote, weirdly awesome, and said, quote, could not have been better, unquote. So what he got out of it was how blown away Marr was by Trump's charm, his humor, how he engaged, claiming there's never been someone that's met the president who's walked away without saying, wow, what a great guy. You know, they toured the White House. Trump took him on the tour. Trump played the host to the full abilities he had. They took him to the Lincoln bedroom. Saw a copy of the Gettysburg Address. He was joking. He was really hammering on Clinton. Marr was on the show. How about we took us to the Lincoln bedroom, you know, the BJ room for, I'm sorry, the Lincoln bedroom, the BJ room for Clinton. Oh, man. So some of the discussion talked about ending wokeness. Wokeness is not going to end as long as you have the Democrats and mainstream media tied to the hip. Talked about securing the border, which Trump has. And Trump asked about Iran and Israel policies. And I agree with Kid Rock. This dinner was an extension of an olive branch by Trump accepting it when Kid Rock initiated in putting it together. And the problem is we condone violence and the mob mentality, and that's how we see our country in two sides. The conservative sides who don't have violence, and the leftist side who will get violent, and then it'll be condoned by the mainstream media. Remember the friendly riots? So, but when you're a person that you're talking, you tend to get along much better. And I think that's what Marr maybe, you know, I don't look as a knowledge branch. Maybe that was a lifeline to, like, this is how it should be. And maybe Marr would learn from that. But the audience was stunned. They probably thought that Marr was going to go off. I knew he wouldn't, because of who Trump is. And Marr has respectability still. And he anticipated the backlash. He, quote, millions of liberal sphincters tightened up when he made the positive remarks about Trump. You know, he addressed those critics, saying he was reporting exactly what happened and didn't care if it wasn't enough pure Trump hate for them. And he's correct. Again, Jimmy Fallon, Mr. Amazon position, Mr. No Cojones, Mr. Vajayjay, and I don't say that lightly. He seems like a very nice guy, but when he bent the knee after he interviewed Trump, this was back in 2020 or 2015 or whatever, years ago, he showed us who he was, a Vajayjay. Marr at least manned up, spoke the truth, told people, F off if you don't like it. So Marr, he got pushback on the show that night, and he put the guy in his place and said, look, you don't have to like it. I told you you wouldn't like it, you know? So I don't think he liked this guy, you know? I don't think he liked him at all. So Marr concluded with, quote, a crazy person doesn't live in the White House. A person who plays a crazy person on TV a lot does. He acknowledged this as, quote, fed up, unquote. Quote, not as fed up as I thought, unquote. This is the bottom line. It was a positive experience for him. Trump is more relatable than he thought, and he still remains critical of Trump's policies. And he underscored the importance of such interactions as what he had as a step forward. And he acknowledged Trump's willing to engage. So Marr's dinner with Trump underscores the potential for dialogue across political divides, even among fierce critics. If you Democrats are willing, because conservatives are always willing to go to the table. So while he remains wary of Trump's policies, Marr's experience suggests personal interactions can humanize opponents, offering a glimmer of hope for civility in a polarized era. My final take, though, personally, I think this was brilliant by Trump. I think humanizing himself to Marr, as he did, showing who he really is, that's going to shape how Marr looks at him moving forward. And I think we're going to notice that. We will see that. He won't defend it, but when he sees other people just jumping all over Trump for this, for that, he'll acknowledge certain things, but he'll also push back. Look, people, right now, I hate to say it, but it's the Democrats that don't want dialogue, the Democrats that don't want peace, the Democrats that are full of vile hate. Doge is removing waste, fraud, and abuse, and Democrats don't want that. Why? Because USAID was a grift that they were able to use government funds, government money, to reward their own people. We saw that. That's documented fact, and they're fighting that. And if they're so concerned about climate change, why are they trying to destroy Tesla? Why? Because he's merely working for Trump, trying to rid us of waste, fraud, and abuse. So right now, it goes back to the BLM, all the riots, billions in destruction, people murdered. Wall Street, the Wall Street, I forget what it was called. Walk on Wall. Anyway, when they had their Wall Street, their big Wall Street years ago, woman rape, robberies, you know, intimidation, you know, within, this was a big old Democrat bloc. Occupy Wall Street, that's what I'm thinking. You know, Bernie, a supporter, taking shots at the congressional representatives at the softball field, baseball field, the Trump assassinations. All this violence is coming from the left. Bill Maher was helping with that violence by the way he was talking about Trump. Maybe this can begin changing it, because Bill Maher has a lot of influence. Maybe he'll get others to think. We can only hope. All right, the paranormal, let's talk. So let's unravel four distinct stories that bridge the mysterious and the monumental, from cosmic enigmas to hidden structures, my friends. Extinct beasts reborn and ancient ruins revealed. So, I want to give credit where credit's due. I came across this at Total Pro Sports, The Hollywood Reporter, Daily Mail, and Archaeology Magazine. The first one is Tic Tac UFOs Rise from the Ocean. So, Jeremy Corbell, he's a big, if you're into the UFOs and these Tic Tacs, and just, you know who Jeremy Corbell is, and George Knapp is a legend in the UFO world. They released never-before-seen Navy footage on their weaponized podcast, prompting the article, not just Total Pro Sports, these articles was everywhere, and it showed Tic Tac, which is nothing but UFOs, emerging from the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Southern California. This was captured by sailors aboard the USS Jackson. This was February 15, 2023, but the video is just now coming out. As you can see, there's a picture there of a Tic Tac. Now, this is an anonymous combat information center where I worked at when I was in the military. Described the four objects as shooting from the water, showing no engine heat or propulsion trails. And this echoes the 2004 USS Nimitz Tic Tac incident. And the footage has been verified with Navy personnel. And Corbell suggests these events hint at advanced, possibly non-human technology. This release, what it's doing, it's going to reignite questions about whether these crafts are classified tech, foreign surveillance, or something else. My take is, I don't think it's human-made. I mean, some people try to say, well, it's us. You know, we're testing this stuff, or it's Russia, China. I think we had this type of technology, it'd already be out there to protect our countries, or even to wage war if it was Russia or China. So we don't know what it is. Is it somebody else from another world? Is it somebody from another dimension? Is it a life form, humanoid, that we don't know about, living beneath the ocean? We don't know. But we do know that the government has finally come out and said, we don't know what these are. And that's what makes this mystery legitimate. Keep an eye on this. I think the reason the government's making these public and allowing them to be made public is something's going to happen, or it's another way to get funding. Hey, we got to protect ourselves against these things eventually. Give us more money, more money, more money. I'm not kidding when I say that. And there's a lot of experts who back what I have just said. All right. Mysterious structures, Area 51's triangular tower. So Google Maps spotted last week this triangular tower at Area 51. And Area 51, for those of you that don't know, it's a U.S. Air Force base in Nevada's desert. When Clinton tried to get some information out of this, the courts ruled against him, saying it was a national security issue. He did not need to know, the president. It's a 155-foot-tall structure It was built between September 2005 and January 2006. Circular base, as you can tell. And may rotate, suggesting specialized function like radar testing or surveillance. They don't know what it is. Theories range from the mundane, an air traffic control tower or phase array radar, to the wild, a UFO docking station or a teleportation device. Now, there are a lot of scientists who believe now, because of the energy, the way our magnetic lines run throughout the Earth, that there are portals, they believe. They don't know what they lead to. History, legends of past civilizations point to portals. So who knows? You know? And obviously social media. It's alien charging docks. Or it's the monolith. From Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey. And what makes all these things go wild is that it's Area 51. It's a secret base. Some of the legends of folklore is from 1989, Bob Lazar's claims of alien aircraft, and the government said, we never heard of Bob Lazar. And somebody shows a base directory, and there's Bob Lazar, you know. So we don't know. But the point is it's in the legend of Area 51 grows. All right. So let's go to Reviving the Past, Dire Wolves Return. And there they are. If I'm correct, what are their names? I got them wrote down here. Romulus and Remus, two dire wolves. So, Colossal Biosciences, they're a Dallas-based biotech firm. They announced in April of 2025 a plan to resurrect the dire wolves, and they did. And they've been extinct for 10,000 years. And, you know, they got famous. Most of us, especially that read the paranormal, we know what dire wolves is just from, what's that, oh my God, I am drawing a blank. Skinwalker Ranch. Back in the 80s, late 80s, a big old giant wolf that some people believe was a dire wolf took a bunch of shots from a Magnum and barely fazed it. You know, part of the legend and lore of Skinwalker Ranch. But so a lot of people have already heard of this. But what, in essence, what happened is this company used something called the CRISPR to insert dire wolf traits, the white coats, the thicker fur, into gray wolf cells, creating hybrids, 99.5% gray wolf DNA. But it does raise questions about whether these are true dire wolves or engineered approximations. I think it's obviously the latter. Unless they have the actual dire wolf DNA, it's not. So there are risks to this. There are risks to this. The dire wolves, just for you who don't know, they were Ice Age predators. They roamed North America, humongous jaws, heavier bills than gray wolves, and their fossils have been found in places like the La Brea tar pits. I knew of them because of I read up on the paranormal all the time. But Game of Thrones fame. I never watch Game of Thrones, don't have HBO, but I can imagine how they were used there, you know. And Romulus and Remus are the names of them again. So there are ethical concerns if the wolves will struggle without their ancestral social structure or prey. My take is even more simplistic. They're bigger than gray wolves. Are they man eaters? We don't know. We don't know what that 0.5% DNA is going to do. You know, we're going to have to wait and see. But their broader mission includes reviving mammoths, who we probably do have the DNA because we haven't frozen, and dodos. And they're backed by $435 million. They're viewed as a de-extinction company in terms of how they see themselves. Some people believe it's just a spectacle. They're making fools of themselves. They're risking creating super wolves. That's my take. You know, it's fine and dandy till one of these dire wolves takes a man out or eats somebody. And trust me, if they're going to do this here, you know it's only a matter of time before we get a Jurassic Park scenario in terms of they try to clone one, you know. So we'll have to wait and see. Okay, so what happens when we have earthquakes? Lots of things happen when the cracks of the world, the earth, happen. And here's one. In this past February in Myanmar, it exposed a buried structure after an earthquake. And my point in this story, we don't know what's under the ground. There's so much history. We talk about lost civilizations. Look at that. That was lost in time. Now, this goes back to the pagan kingdom, the 9th through 13th century. So it's not. It's fairly recent, you know, in terms of the history of this. But it was lost. This was lost. And what else is lost? What's underwater that's lost? So this is a buried structure in Bagan. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And as I said, it was like, from the between 9th and 13th centuries, this was likely a palace or temple from the pagan kingdom. And this is a lost piece of history. And Bagan was once the capital with over 10,000 temples, Buddhist powerhouse. Then the Mongol invasions came. And then seismic activity, an earthquake buried much of the glory. My point in this is, when they talk about lost civilizations, here's proof. This is proof. This also happened in 1975 in a show, a hidden mural. So Myanmar there's a lot of earthquake and seismic activity. Now, here's the other problem is, when you try to, archaeologists go in, they're going to be dealing with monsoons, political instability. So we don't know. This one here is more modern, but, you know, if we ever find a lost civilization like Göbekli Tepe or whatever, how do you pronounce that? Hold on one second. Göbekli Tepe was found in Turkey. They're saying it was purposely buried. If I'm correct, it's at least 12,000 years old. Let me see this on Göbekli Tepe. I want to say it's like 10,000 years old. Yeah, 12,000 years old. 12,000 years old. It's been abandoned for 9,000 years, purposely buried. There's some freaky stuff they found. They're not digging it out. They're waiting. It's come to a crawl. I think with some lost history, they don't want us to know what that history really is because it upends our traditional beliefs. And I don't say that as a paranormal reader or anything like that. Science is wrong. Archaeology is wrong. It's not always right. It's a lot of assumptions are made in those trades. So the Myanmar just proves there are civilizations that are buried under the sand. So, from whispers of alien secrets to shadows of lost kingdoms, baby, these stories weave a tapestry of wonder and possibility. At least to me, they do. Whether it's science-defined extinction, governments dodging truth, or Earth itself revealing history. Each one of these stories challenges what we think we know. Stay open, my friend. Keep your mind open is all I ask to the mysteries. And we'll eventually return to the Red, White, and Rude with more stories like this. All right. Hollywood and movies, reality checks. Let's dive into the movie segment, buzzing with Hollywood's latest pulse, capturing the industry's highs and the industry lows. More lows than highs recently. So four stories are driving the talk here today. Minecraft's fan-powered upset, Lawrence Fishburne's Matrix standoff, that was interesting. The Fantastic Four's reboot, wrestling with Marvel Comic Universe's woke baggage. Sue Storm, that's a piece of work, that actress. And China's tariff-fueled grip on Tinseltown. We're going to round it out with Thunderbolts, and that's going to test Marvel's spark under similar scrutiny if they can survive. This is the final movie, I think, the Phase 5, and it's not looking good. So, let's first talk about Minecraft's mode-breaking triumph. So, the Minecraft movie grossed over $400 million globally. All right, let's talk about the Minecraft movie here. Made lots of money. Lots of money. I'm trying to find my notes how much exactly it made in the first week. And this is actually entering the second week of release, but it grossed over $400 million globally already. It's dwarfed any other video game adaptions. Mortal Kombat's $84 million, Tomb Raider $274 million. It had a $100 million budget. So that is a big budget. But it's a lean budget compared to what Marvel's been doing, $250 million. And Unlike other failed game adaptions, Assassin's Creed 240 million was a critical flop. Warcraft 440 million, a domestic dud. China helped save it. So Minecraft has sidestepped all of that. It's a 90-minute adventure, and it's kind of mirrored the game's open-ended style, not Hollywood's over-engineered epic. So it doesn't line up exactly with the game, to be quite honest here, but the director leaned into the Minecraft's core, the building, the surviving, the exploring, and he had practical sets. It mimicked the blocky aesthetics, unlike Sonic CGI style, but those are two different genres, actually. So they gained the fan trust. The actors were not important here as much as the story itself, the sets, how the director went around. This movie was not marketed around the actors. So, this is what you call light escapism. You know, and that's kind of what this country wants. I mean, we're being shoved. Woke this, woke that, woke this, woke that. This was more geared towards a lighter fare, you know? There's 140 million active players who play this game. So they had a base to go from. Then there was the TikTok frenzy. See, the thing about Minecraft, I guess, I don't know if I'm correct. I've always envisioned it kind of like today's modern Lego, you know, computer-wise, you know, for this generation. But there were fan trailers, there were cosplay screenings, TikTok frenzy all over this. So they got the fans involved. Gaming used to do this. When they would put a new game, and I'm sure they probably still do, but they have all this free stuff for the fans to go make their own trailers and make their wallpaper, stuff like that. That kind of changed a bit, you know? The fans were looked at as secondary. Like, you're just going to accept what we like in the gaming world. And that has hurt the release of some of these adaptations because Hollywood is taking it to continue that mental attitude. So this game did not, or this movie did not do that. So it's an anti-formula here, and because what Hollywood did, they'll bank on Dwayne Johnson and Rampage, you know, for example. So maybe this game is an industry wake-up. You don't have to spend $200, $300 million. You don't have to have that bloat. Brad Pitt makes a lot of money. His movies barely make a profit because of the cost of the movie, his salary, etc. Tom Cruise, too. Woody Allen, on the flip side, always made a profit. He'd only pay his actors X amount. That was it. Don't like it, don't do it. And this shows Hollywood can be successful if they go back to that model. Have a budget-smart adaptions. Let's hope Zelda is the same way. So congratulations to Minecraft. I had to look. Let's move on to Matrix 5, Fishburne's Power Play. So Lawrence Fishburne, in an interview, who plays Morpheus, he pitched himself returning for the Matrix Resurrections, but was iced out by Warner Brothers. And now he's guarded on his stance on the next Matrix 5. He's open to coming back, but he says Matrix 5 needs Keanu Reeves, Carrie Ann Moss, and a script that respects the 1999 original's philosophical depth, not Resurrection's divisive, woke crap. I mean, my God. They made Neo a cuck in this movie, of a JJ, pajama girl, boy, whatever. You know, I saw The Matrix Resurrections. I couldn't resist it. I hadn't seen it. I wanted to see it at the theater. I didn't because I saw the bad reviews. So I saw it on a plane for free, thinking, okay, I'll check it here. And then I'll catch it on a big screen. It was so bad when it came to Netflix and I have a big screen TV. I haven't even watched it on there. That's how bad and poor that movie was. Yeah. Resurrections tanked with $157 million. The budget was $190 million. It only made $157 million. It needed $570 million. Just to break even using Hollywood's three-time budget rule. Matrix Reloaded made $742 million. WB needs to get it together. Stop with the woke nonsense. Bring the original crew back. Have underlings under them, but they're still the stars. That's why we watched The Matrix, was for them. Not to see a woke Carrie Ann Fisher or Carrie Ann, whatever her name is, Carrie Ann Moss become the star and Keanu Reeves. No, we watched because Neo was the one. So Fishburne's wariness reflects the broader fan distrust after Resurrection's debacle. They sidelined the core themes of the Matrix, the free will, the reality for self-awareness, the gags. You know, Easter eggs, I guess, is what people would say. Reboots are dicey. Ghostbusters, they've all been a joke. I think the Matrix 5 could succeed, but not if Hollywood thinks they're going to hand it off to a new generation who has no clue. It's like my favorite comedy, Frasier. Frasier came back, redid it. It was terrible, horrible. They went away from the original formula. So what's next? Rumors swirl of a prequel or multiverse angle. Who cares? Let's bring Fishburne back. Let's bring Reeves back. Let's bring Carrie Ann Moss back. Let's bring the original crew back. Hell, find a way for somebody to have Mr. Smith on a disc and plug it in. All right. Let's get to the Fantastic Four's reboot tightrope. Well, real quick, before we go into that, The Matrix was a you're not going to be able to miss type movie. There's movies like that. And granted, that's just a statement, a saying, but it's based off the assumption. Just don't screw it up. When you screw things up, go away from what made the original movies so good. It's the theme, like I said, the self-awareness. It's the joking with themselves. Neo being the one. When you start going away from that, in this case with Resurrection, becoming just woke trash garbage, well acted. I mean, I can't argue for that about that. Can't argue the CGI or any of that. But the story was horrible. And then there, at a point, you go, "Oh God, not again! Can't I just enjoy a movie?" And until Hollywood understands that, they're going to continue losing big money. Snow White, Captain America. Look, Steve Rogers, Captain America. You know, not the guy who they have playing him. You know, stuff like that. Go back to the core. All right, let's move on to Fantastic Four's reboot, which I believe is likely to be another failure. So Marvel Comics Universe's High Wire Act, Fantastic Four First Steps, comes out this July. And it aims to launch Phase 6 of the Marvel Comics Universe. The 2015 one bombed. They went woke. They also, as minorities love to say, they culturally appropriated Johnny Storm, who was Sue Storm's brother. One's white, one's black. That can happen. But it was because they were woke. In a tank, fans did not want it. Once they saw that, half the fans were out. And it had nothing to do with racism. It has, you're changing everything up. And the Comics Corps, the 1960s Comic Corps, was set in a certain era. They fail. Every movie has failed to capture that essence because they tried to modernize it. I wish they would do a Fantastic Four in the 60s before with the space race, etc., etc. The modernity shift, diverse casting, social themes, progressive agendas, the Marvels, Thor, Love and Thunder. You know, so first step, is it going to continue? So Johnny Storm was a womanizer, loved women, a hot, good looking. He was a playboy. They're taking that away. But the worst one is Sue Storm. She was like the mama figure. She was the one who kept all that testosterone in check. She was the maternal anchor. She had a warmth that steadied the team's testosterone. She could shift it from an overly assertive message to bringing it back. And this is all the comics I'm talking about. Now, they're risking all that because the actress who's playing her said, "I wanted a little bit of this woke Sue." And she hasn't necessarily said that, but that's what she wants. Phase 5 has struggled. Marvel Comics Universe Phase 5's Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania, was a bust. And it just went on. Captain America, the Marvels, all of that crap. There's a perception problem. So even if First Steps avoids heavy agendas, there's a woke stigma with the Marvel Comics Universe. And it's cemented by Phase 5's divisive reception. We don't like it. We don't want it. We're not going to pay to see it. Pedro Pascal's Reed Richards and Vanessa Kirby's Sue Storm, that's the star power. I'll be honest. nobody knows who Pedro Pascal is. He's just another average name in an industry that now lacks superstars in terms of superstars being able to get people out to the theater. There's rumor tweets to Galactus, and they're going to gender swap the Silver Surfer. Oh my God, see, that's what I mean by the wokeness. When you're adapting tales, purists will always rule. That's your foundation for paying to see it. And when you ruin that, you ruin your movie. Marvel's is actually at crossroads. DC, Disney is with this. We'll see how it pans out. I think until you get back, I mean, you can adapt. My take is you can adapt a lot of these comic book stories. But when you veer away from them to shift your message in, you begin to fail. That's what Phase 5 has been. Let's move on to China. Hollywood's tied to China's $7 billion market. They're not tied. They just want in. They reshape their films to dodge Beijing censorship. No politics, no bow themes. I actually don't mind that, to be quite honest. They do all that to secure releases. Fans call that a sellout. I'm like, I get why China does it. Completely different culture. But I'm tired of the wokeness. And China's like, we're going to have none of that. You want in on here? You remove all that crap. And they do. And what's even worse for Hollywood, they'll make like a quarter off of each dollar over there. Maybe less, 10 cents to 25 cents off of each dollar. So how big could that $7 billion market be? And they're also competing against Chinese movies as well. So right now there's a tariff fallout. We all know about Trump's tariffs. Scott Bessent's doing a marvelous job. Everything's going as planned despite what the mainstream media. China is actually the long-term goal here and to take down. So they have a renewed ban on U.S. films, and it's linked to the trade wars and tariffs hitting Chinese goods. Could lock movies out to China. You know, because they're going to retaliate via cultural exports like Hollywood. So what I'm trying to say is it's going to be harder for Hollywood to get their movies in there. China's purposely attacking this. They think they can drive a wedge between Trump and Hollywood. They don't realize there's already a Grand Canyon wedge there, and Trump doesn't care about Hollywood in that sense. So we'll see how this plays out. But right now, Hollywood is at risk because of this tariff wars for 10 to 25 cents on the dollar. $7 billion market doesn't mean they're making that. They're not. They're far from it. Back to what they do, you know, Hollywood. You know, they shove this crap down our throats. But they'll cut their scripts. They'll soften the edges. They'll scrub the subtext. They'll do whatever they can to pass the censors. And it's costing them. In their hypocrisy. How the hell they can look in the mirror, I don't know. It's not costing them in hypocrisy. They don't care about that, to be quite honest. It's costing them in the sense of this political war is costing them entry into the pennies they make, and they don't like that. Why? They need China's market. Their market here is failing. There was a time they would make 70, 80% of their money domestically, 25% globally. Now it's the exact opposite, because domestically we don't like the trash they're putting out. So Beijing's curbing films to counter their economic hits, and they don't like that. They're trying to use Hollywood as leverage in a trade feud. It's not going to work. This is the battle you have no clue on, China. We don't care. Let Hollywood go broke. That's what I think. Now, Hollywood is dying right now. They're not dying. They're always going to be around. But in terms of the big money they've been making, the last 10 years have been, especially since COVID, it's been a nightmare for Hollywood. And they need those pennies from China, and this is really going to hurt. It's going to slash massive budgets, and I love it. I love it. Avengers Endgame, it earned millions there. It was not a woke movie. Is China looking to limit U.S. soft power? Yes. Pushing studios to align with narratives and state values? Well, that's kind of helping the woke agenda. So Hollywood's getting hit from all sides here. So Hollywood's at a fork in the road. Sanitize the films for China's box office or stick to their guns where they won't and have the market close to them. That's the setup they're in. But now with the potential blockage of these Chinese films, I mean of the entry into China, they're really screwed in an environment they can't control. China's going to war with the U.S. politically here. And Hollywood is a potential casualty. Again, I don't care. Hollywood can go die tomorrow. They don't even film a lot of movies or shows in Hollywood anymore. New Mexico, Georgia, North Carolina, in Eastern Europe. Because it's too expensive. So go broke. I don't care. The fact that y'all are going to become casualties of this war does not bother me one iota. Because every person in that industry is 99% of those people are leftists who would see me dead. I have no love for them. Do I want to see you lose your job? No, I don't. But I'm not going to sit there and look at you as like, oh my God, we got to protect Hollywood. Oh. It's kind of like a woman protecting her abuser. You're like, let it go. I'm letting it go. All right, let's move on to Thunderbolts. Marvel Comic Universe is Gamble. So Thunderbolts, it's a 70 to 90 million expected domestic debut coming out this May. That scene is a weak start. You know, in it trails Captain America Civil War, 179 million. It signals the continual cracks that are turning into chasms with Marvel's Phase 5 run. It's an anti-hero movie. You know, Sebastian Stan's Bucky Barnes, he leads Florence Pugh and David Harbour in what is seen or being called a gritty spy thriller. That's a spin they're giving it. Very niche tone, they say. It's not a niche tone. We all love superheroes, even superheroes we're not aware of. But with a $300 million budget? Are you kidding me? There's also potential perception of being woke, whether it is or not. Every Marvel Phase 5 movie has had the wokeness in it or aspects of it. We are not sure about Thunderbolts. Its style leans dark and chaotic right now. However, some on social media are talking about woke trends, diverse casts, which we don't care about. We just want a good story. But the forced messaging from that cast, that's what we don't like. The Marvels, Thor, Love and Thunder, Captain America. Let's go keep Disney. Snow White. Every other Disney movie. But see, Disney owns the Marvel Comics universe. So everything coming out of the Disney house is woke. And they talk a good game, but they still keep producing woke crap. But eventually, this billion-dollar empire that's called Disney, eventually shareholders are going to go, what the bleep? Ant-Man again. Perception is already built in. That's why I think just the thought that this movie may have cost $300 million. And even if they skip the heavy-handed themes, their woke reputation, fueled again by Phase 5's divisive reception, it's going to curb the buzz. Another Eternal-style misfire. I mean, go back to the No Way Home. It's a simple, nice little story. Not $1.9 billion hit. The trailers don't really tell you what's happening either. It's pushing a lot of chaos. Like, okay, what's the story about? What's the upside? I don't call it an upside. But they're trying to tie to Captain America Brave New World. Which will break even at best. So a flop could sink Marvel Comic Universe's slate. Fewer films, leaner budgets. That's good, actually, I think. That's what I want. I don't need woke. I don't need too many movies where the storylines are diluted with average. There's a lot of average and terrible writing. So now, if Thunderbolts fails, I don't think we're going to get a Blade movie that has been in development hell. Hell, I think you should just bring Wesley Snipes back as Blade, you know, with an older storyline, you know? He was popular. And there you have it, my friends. That is the Hollywood Pulse. Triumphs, clashes, and high-stakes bets. Minecraft's $400 million win is rewriting the game, showing fans hold the cards. You deliver what fans want, we will show up. Fishburne's Matrix stand, hey, you have a great cast, or you bring back the old cast, have a great storyline, and I'm in. Because you didn't want me for the last woke crap you did. And now with that woke crap, I'm thinking twice with this Matrix 5. Fantastic Four, comic love, or Marvel Comic Universe's Phase 5 woke shadow is what we're seeing here. Fans are on edge. I'm not. I've already got it as woke based off the interview of the actress that's playing Sue Storm. Them taking away Johnny Storm's Playboy attitude. So, no, I'm not even going to bother. You know, I do have Disney Plus. It's forced on me because I have Hulu. They forced Disney Plus and ESPN Plus. I'm paying an extra, what, $10 a month on it for it, if not more, for that crap. I can tell you how many times on one hand over the past year I've gone to Disney. One was for Moon Knight. That was maybe a couple years ago now, 2-3 years ago now, not longer. And then I went for Wolverine, Deadpool and Wolverine. And we're probably going to watch Mona too, but that's about it. I can count on one hand. You have nothing that I like, Disney. Then we cover China's terror-fueled grip. It's going to test the studio's spine. Not really. They've already bent the knee to China. There, we're going to see how much of the fallout Hollywood can deal with. I think all this wokeness, China, everything, Hollywood's going to become leaner. It's going to take this. It's like a drunk hitting rock bottom and realizing I need to change. This is what's happening with Hollywood. Between China, the political war with the U.S. over terrorists that's starting up, combined with the censorship, combined with the wokeness, combined with the domestic audience cratering, the global audience plateauing at best. These are the fault lines of where movies are headed, I believe. Now, there's plenty to unpack as we keep moving forward, and I will make sure I bring that to you. All right, let us move on to television and streaming news, Ugly Tales. So let's unpack two seismic stories in entertainment today. We're going to dive into the collapse of a major franchise project and a legal battle that's rocking Hollywood, and it will rock it. Props to The Park Place and bounding into comics and The Bleeding Fool. So we're going to talk about Amazon's Tomb Raider debacle and Gina Carano's courtroom win against Disney. So let's break it down. So we're going to start with Gina Carano. Federal judge denied Disney's motion to dismiss her wrongful termination lawsuit. That happened a while ago. That's just bringing you up to speed. So Carano was fired from The Mandalorian in 2021 over a social media post, while Pedro Pascal was allowed to post all his political crap he wanted with nothing happening to him. That is free speech issue in the minds of many. I don't. They can sit there and do what they want, but it's hypocritical. And that's what she's saying. Why'd you fire me? You treated me differently. See, that's the thing about law and precedent. When you allow one thing to happen to somebody, then you let somebody go or fire somebody or punish them for doing the same thing, that's when the courts can come in and go, well, we don't care if you're private. You treated this person differently than that person. And that's kind of what's happened here. You know, so the court ordered Disney to produce documents. They've been stonewalling these documents that her team has requested, and by legal rights, they should have. And Disney has been withholding them. And these documents are critical to proving the discriminatory practices. I think what Disney has been doing is cleaning it up, destroying documents. My opinion. I'm not saying they have, but I believe they probably have destroying documents, destroying evidence, and they're going to hand them nothing. But regardless, they have to turn it over per the court. So she hailed the ruling as a step toward justice, and I agree. And so the lawsuit, if you haven't figured it out, alleges Disney targeted Carano for her political opinions. And she's seeking reinstatement and damages. I think Disney's going to eventually settle out. Now, who's backing Carano? Elon Musk and S-Corp. They're funding her case. Good for her. They're framing this as a stand against Hollywood's alleged cancel culture. And I agree. I agree. This ruling will influence how studios navigate talent contracts amid public backlash over personal beliefs. I think what they need to do, get them to sign a release. You will not talk politics. You are an actor. Politics are destroying us. No politics. Well, then you don't want the job bad enough then. And that's for either or. I just want to enjoy the movie. I don't care about your politics, actor, actress. I want to enjoy your role there. But once you know your politics, and I will never watch another Robert De Niro movie. There's some show he has on Netflix. I'm like, I'm going to watch it. Screw him. You're missing some good quality shows. No, I'm not. I say this every other week on this show. I'm watching a lot of Indian films, a lot of Asian films, a lot of Nordic films, Sweden, you know, those type. I've actually grown as a viewer. You should too. All right, Amazon's live-action Tomb Raider series, led by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, is canceled after years in development. No script and no deliverables produced. If I'm Amazon, I'm looking to sue that woman. Why? It cost them an estimated $100 million, covering development and Waller-Bridge's deals. They got nothing out of $100 million. She's known for Fleabag and destroying the Indiana Jones final movie. $60 million 3-year deal contract. Got nothing. And then renewals. No projects were completed. They renewed her deal in 2023 in November 2024. And they made it even better for her. They don't even get first look. She can shop it to whoever she wants. Or something like that. Meaning they don't have an exclusive rights. For all that money, those rights should be exclusive for the next 20 years for whatever she does. Two writers failed to produce a workable script. She should have been producing a God-given script with $100 million. You want to know the honest truth? The honest truth is we dodge a bullet. This is who they wanted to play the two women under consideration for the casting rumors. That said, nothing was finalized. Lucy Boynton. Does that look like Laura Croft to you? No, not even close. Like, come on, man. This Sophia Turner. Sophie Turner. Oh, my God. It's oh, at least she, oh, no. We dodge a bullet, people. We dodge a bullet. Then there's Jennifer Salke, former Amazon MGA studio head. She championed Waller-Bridge's deals. And she's the one who extended the deal on her way out the door. I think that was a big FU to Amazon. Why should I'm going to give your money away here. She exited early 2025 amid the project's collapse. I'm telling you, that's me. I'm taking Phoebe Waller to court. I'm taking her to court. I fall in line with some fans who welcome the cancellation. I don't have any, but I'm not a Waller Bridges fan. I think she's overrated. She's part of the Hollywood elite. Who knows? I had no clue, but when I see her, I think Harvey Weinstein is how she kind of moved up. I'm not saying she did, but that's just what comes to my mind when I see somebody like her. I mean, Waller Bridges, Vision, Turner, oh, Boynton, oh, no, no, no. Oh, my God. So despite the flop, Tomb Raider continues with Netflix's animated series. There's a new game, and we will see it eventually, probably in the next couple of years in some form or fashion, coming back on as a television series or big movie. See, I just adapt one of the games and you'd be fine. It'd be a massive hit, but you won't. You won't. You always have to put in your stupidity. Now, I have to admit the last movie, the big screen one, did kind of adapt aspects of the other one. And I enjoyed it, but it did not take with the audience. Don't have the big screaming budget. Understand what it is. But fine, it was the script writing was poor, I thought. That's what killed that movie. And there's the post for today's streaming world. Gina Carano's legal win, forcing Disney to hand over critical documents, is huge. It keeps the fight for free speech front and center. Meanwhile, Amazon's Tomb Raider fiasco, $100 million down the toilet, like a turd in a punch bowl. Nothing to show. It's a stark reminder of the risks of big budget bets. Or is it paying favors to friends? So these stories just shows the chaos and stakes of Hollywood's industry. All right, let's close it out here with the gaming industry. Woke strikes again. The video games industry is facing serious turbulence. We've got two stories again from Park Place that dig into the chaos. First, South of Midnight, that it's tied to Sweet Baby Inc., which is a woke studio that shows gaming studios what they need to do to be accepted by woke so they're not attacked. Kind of like what Jesse Jackson used to do in the 70s, Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. If you don't do as we say, we're going to have a bunch of minorities picketing in front of your corporation. Since there was no streaming, since there was only three ways to show this on television through networks, they had a powerful audience when the students within the networks would cover it. That's kind of what Sweet Baby Inc. does in gaming. That's my opinion. So, South of Midnight is developed by Compulsion Games. It's a part of a Microsoft family. It's a Microsoft studio. And the narrative consulting came from Sweet Baby Inc. So, it just launched this past week with Steam Early Access. It's on Xbox Game Pass. So obviously, that's a Microsoft-owned product. But it peaked at a measly 1,400 concurrent players on Steam. 1,400 people were playing it on Steam. It's a shockingly low number for a hyped Xbox exclusive. Exact sales are murky because Gamebox, it won't tell us in terms of early sales. But Steam's low turnout. Analysts are estimating 15,000 units sold. I don't know if it's a AAA title. I don't think it is. It's more of an indie type. But you got to have strong sales. And if it's Microsoft, there's money being put into it that's probably higher than most indies. Why did it fail? Well, most people think it's because of Sweet Baby Inc. Sweet Baby Inc. is a company that was founded in 2008 by an ex-woke Ubisoft writer named Kim Belair. Let me suck you dry in wokeness or I will do everything to destroy you. And early on, they could. I can't remember the Chinese company. They tried to extort, and this is allegedly, $6 million from them. Oh, Black Myth Wukong, so their game would be accepted. Black Myth Wukong said, no, 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 you go somewhere out there, you little big than Sweet Baby Inc. And they said, no. 20 million units sold in a month. Sweet Baby Inc. destroys games. She supposedly, Kim Belair supposedly, now this is just my opinion. I don't know if it's true, but this is my research. But I also look at the results of the games they've worked on and their sales. But she supposedly specializes in authentic storytelling. I disagree. But what I don't disagree is she emphasizes diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. To the point games fail. Because most people like myself, we're not going to buy that crap. She's had flops, Suicide Squad, Kill the Justice League, Flintlock, The Siege of Dawn, all kinds of other games as well. So, part of South of Midnight's failure that many believe is on Sweet Baby's influence, their DEI-driven narrative, centered on a black protagonist. Look, I have played as black characters. I don't care. What I care about is a crappy story, the terrible voice acting, and the woke messaging. So Hazel is exploring Southern folklore. We wanted gameplay over woke storytelling. I mean, I'd buy South of Midnight if it was any good. I buy games where I see the reviews are great from the other gamers. I don't buy them from magazines, whether Game Informer or Game Rant, PC Mag, or Gamer, or whatever. I look for what the people are saying. Not with the companies. Why not the companies? Well, the companies have been paid money for advertising with a wink, wink. Our review is looking good, huh? Wink, wink. Yes, it is. Okay, here's that $30,000 we promised for next month's advertising. That I've seen that firsthand in the magazine industry, not gaming, but in other industries, and I've been told that by publishers. So a Steam review cited preachy dialogue and clunky mechanics, and they quit after 90 minutes. Now, this doesn't help. I don't know if it's true. But see, this is what hurts him. Hazel, they said, was originally an Anglo character who was race swapped after Sweet Baby Inc. came in and put their thumbs on it. That came through Grums on X. So I don't know if that's true. But we're at an era where tribalism is so bad that whether... It wouldn't matter in the past. Now it matters. It's like you're trying to whitewash everything. And using your own language, you have just culturally appropriated something. So it's the messaging. It's what trying to shove down the throat of people who just want to play a good game. So when they hear this, they're like, why bother? I'm not going to waste my $30 on this indie game. I say 30 because indie games tend to be much cheaper. I don't know how much this is going to cost. But this is what people call forced inclusivity. Fair or not, that's what it is. No different than Assassin's Creed Shadows, which is tanking. It's going to earn money, but it needs to earn blockbuster money. It's not going to earn that. Real quick, Compulsion Games was acquired by Microsoft in 2018. I guess it was riding high after We Happy Few's niche success, but South of Midnight is their biggest big-budget game, and it's a bomb. They say it's vibrant stop motion style art. It looked kind of nice when I saw it. But if it's a terrible game, see, graphics no longer can make a game. Got to have a good story. Sweet Baby Inc., they're struggling. Their website went offline briefly in December. Sony reportedly has canceled projects with them. Former employee Kazuma Hashimoto claims developers now avoid ex-Sweet Baby staff because of fan backlash. Now, they have their supporters. They have their bigots and their racists supporting them. They're calling these people trash. Pikachulita, part of Sweet Baby's community manager, calls gamers bigots. That's not going to help sales. You can't attack your base. You attack me, I'm not going to buy your game. Why would I buy something to support you if you look at me like a moron? I'm not going to waste my money. This flop will probably likely shut Compulsion down because Microsoft is shutting their studios down rather rapidly as of late. I also believe Sweet Baby's days are numbered. All right, let's move on to the final topic of the night. Ubisoft stock crashed below $10, $11 this past April. 85% plunge. $10.60. They were once worth $84.80 in 2021. Their market cap is about $1.8 billion, where it was originally $12.2 billion. Dire sign. Debt's crushing them. Net debt of $1.2 billion. This is an IFRS net debt. That's as a... Their cash reserves, I think, are... I'm looking at my notes here. Are about $933 million, barely covering operations. Revenue's tanking. 23-24 brought in $2.4 billion. But the second quarter of 24-25 fell to $348 million, down 31.5% year over year. Employee costs alone hit $747 million. $791 million. That's unsustainable without big hits. Ubisoft's been bleeding since 2020. Flops like Skull and Bones, supposedly $650 to $850 million in USD costs. Minimal sales. Star Wars Outlaw. Weak sales. Pan with all the bugs. With the ugliness of the characters. X Defiance shut down this past December. 300 layoffs. They're dying. It's fan alienation. Ubisoft's DEI push, especially Assassin's Creed Shadows. Every protagonist in their Assassin's Creed franchise has been somebody from that country. They made it a black samurai who was never a black samurai. Then they tried to tell the world, no, he was a black samurai in real life. We're historical. Then when they were busted with all lie after lie after lie after lie, oh, no, can't y'all, this is a game. Why are y'all looking at us for truth? See the double, see the hypocrisy? There's no trust with them. An Ubisoft Japan trailer got a 70% dislike. Layoffs are rampant. Ubisoft Leamington, they just closed their doors. Studios in Dusseldorf and Stockholm are facing cuts. A restructuring is planned for June, July 2025. Jobs are going to go. That's what that means. They're going to try to do everything to dodge bankruptcy. Tencent circling their drain. They've got a new subsidiary because of Tencent. Shareholders are suing to renegotiate because of the subsidiary. Tencent put in a billion, and it's a new company with no debt, and they put all the debt on the current company. So even though they own a subsidiary, it's kind of like a little bit separate. And Tencent's going to eventually force this buyout, force Ubisoft to sell, which is what I think the founders want. And the founders need to step back, Guillaume, or whatever the hell their names are. Just bad decision after bad decision. Now, in their defense, they're mirroring wider trends that we're seeing with other woke companies, EA and Activision Blizzard. They've also cut staff. Gamers have ditched bloated AAA titles, shoving woke messages down. We're going to indies or live service games that don't send this type of crap message. Ubisoft ignored its core audience, and that's why they're circling the drain. So if Assassin's Creed completely flops, meaning it does, it's going to make money, but if it doesn't make the money they need it to make, they're done. They're probably going to see insolvency by 2026. Especially with $318 million in bonds due soon. You know. Ubisoft's a sinking ship. There you have it. I tried to cover everything in the entertainment culture. So these stories hit like a 1-2 punch. South of Midnight's collapse. Under 1,500 players for a Game Pass darling. It shows Sweet Baby Inc.'s narrative gambles are not paying off. They never really did. It just, sometimes it takes a while for these companies to realize that, and I don't know if Microsoft still has. These narrative gambles aren't paying off. Fans are loudly rejecting them. These are agenda-driven games. Ubisoft? Ubisoft's fall, drowning in $1.4 billion of debt and a string of misfires. It warns that even giants with can't miss games can crumble when they alienate their players. So what do we get out of these two stories? We get the same truth. In gaming, ignore your audience at your peril. So we'll be watching to see what happens here. So, that's my show. That is my show, my friends. I hope you enjoyed it. Before I close it out, do not forget to bookmark grumblingsmedia.com. You can also catch us on other platforms, Rumble, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, or Pandora under the handle Grumblings Media. You can check out my points on the board. That's where I do sports culture and how it intermixes with politics at times. And I have my conservative podcast, Fired Up and Fired Up California, the former dealing with national issues, the latter with local issues. Thank you for tuning in, my friends. I hope you enjoyed our take from Mayor Mars White House munchies to gaming's woke woes. I hope I peel back the layers of what I see as a wild war, wild world. So stay rude, stay curious, and we'll catch you next time. I am William Del Pilar for the Red, White, and Rude. And until next week, I bid you adieu.